Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
It is the Anfield Wrap coming from Man Island on a Monday morning after Liverpool have beaten Burnley by 1-0 before they go to Inter Milan for what will be a very, very, very big game against the Italian champions who currently sit second with me. I've got Ian Salmon, Phil Blundell and Josh Sexton. You can download the Anfield Wrap app to get all of our excellent post-match coverage every single game. Burnley done in a car, pulling away from Turf Moor, as you would expect. It was excellent to be at Turf Moor yesterday because Phil Blundell, it was unremittingly grim at Turf Moor yesterday. It was everything Turf Moor should be, and let's be honest about it, always will be.
Yeah, there's sometimes when Burnley away is a bit of a parody, isn't there? And there was nothing that was a parody about that yesterday, was it? It ticked every single box. Every single box. It was wet, it was windy, it was horrible. It was hard going, wasn't it? About 5 minutes in, I was watching it, and I didn't think Burnley were very Burnley in a weird way. They seemed to be a bit more front foot, a bit higher, a bit more aggressive, a bit happy to have a go. And
I want to just come back to that very quick.
Sure.
One of the things that gets missed, I think, about what Burnley are when they are backing themselves is how high he has that line. Mm. So there was a point about 35 minutes where Nick Pope had a free kick, and it was about two-thirds of the way into... And I sort of want to contextualise this, because some people listening to this might not have been able to see the game. They might only have seen highlights for a variety of reasons, streams given and out, and also just on a stream, you don't feel like you get the full story. So there was Nick Pope took this free kick, and he was about halfway, two-thirds of the way into the Burnley half. And all the Burnley defenders, the deepest any of them was the halfway line. Our lads were 20 yards further on, and all the players were narrow. So there was basically 22 massive lads, to hasten to add, in this space that was effectively 20 yards by 35 yards that Nick Pope was playing the ball into. That's how front foot Burnley were all game.
It's second balls and flick-ons, isn't it? That's what they're very interested in, you know. They've got an absolute mountain of a fella up front. Does he look big in real life?
He's huge in real life, isn't he, Phil?
Were you very excited?
When he walked out, I was like, look at him. That can't be allowed. And he's got lovely touch.
Yeah, he played very well. I thought he played well. He caused a little bit of havoc, but how much havoc he actually caused is open to massive interpretation, which we'll presumably come on to talk about later.
We will indeed. Ian, this is exactly the sort of win we were saying, the sort of game we were saying we sort of wanted around the time of the drop points against Leicester and Chelsea. Leicester was a horrible evening from a Liverpool point of view. Chelsea was a classic. It was like we've had enough of classics. This was most definitely not a classic in any way, shape or form. It was an absolute scrap for Liverpool.
This was one of the most horrible 90 minutes of football I think I've ever watched, and I watched it from the safety and warmth of my own home. So I didn't get the horizontal rain. I didn't get the gale force winds at the corner flag going at 60-degree angles to the floor. It was hideous. It was just, there were no redeeming virtues that game of football at all. If you were in neutral, it would be the worst thing you've ever watched in your life. I loved the fact that we got through it with a win, and that was all that was necessary. And we these are the games we need to grind out, because it was, you know, even though Burnley may not have been very Burnley, the game itself was the most Burnley game of football in the history of mankind, because it depended on being out in the middle of nowhere with horrendous weather. And I was watching it 20 minutes and I was like, hold on, City beat these 5-0 every time they play them.
I know, it does drive me mad. Yeah. Are we getting bogged down in this when City beat these 5-0 every time they play them?
We are just dragged down to their level, but City beat them 5-0 every single time. But City never seemed to play them in anything other than glorious sunshine.
The update plays in June. That can't be.
Sunglasses.
I don't know. This is along with how City managed to play Norwich once a fortnight. I don't think they managed to play Burnley in the sun all the time when nobody else ever seen the sunshine there. No, it was. It's one of those games that you needed to win. It was. I know. Listening to the Pink. Listening to the Pink, I want to know what the Volkswagen driver did that was so.
Yeah,
nice.
I wanted to know this as well. It was an excellent bit of commentary from Paul.
Yeah, and he was really, really helpful. We could still be in Turf Moor now. I hadn't stepped in when he did.
It is, Josh, you know, I'll say it again. I think Burnley play, it's interesting Dyche's comments post-match because he talks about the chances and we'll come on as to the offside nature and all of that, but he says we created chances. He's very much, we played really well in the last couple of games. And I think ultimately one of the things that Liverpool do run into, and maybe it's something that we've got to maybe reassess over a period of time, but Burnley play about as well as they can. I think Liverpool, that I didn't feel at any point like I was watching a team who were 20th. And I think that I was concerned about that before kickoff, but as that game sort of wearing on, certainly for the first half at least, this just did not look like a team that's 20th in this division.
Yeah, Burnley are a dead interesting case study, I think, because they very sort of subtly tweaked the system. That's what I think Phil was sort of hinting at before, is that it didn't feel very Burnley in the sense that the classic Burnley you felt that you got is almost like a bit, I don't know if it's like kick up to the big man and catch the flick-ons. This was a bit more like kick and run. They've obviously got Corne in, who they put a lot of currency in, and rightly so. I think he looks like a dead exciting footballer, and there's a few other lads there. I think Josh Brownhill in midfield as well was particularly good yesterday. And I think there's a couple there who have sort of got that kind of technical ability almost that you don't necessarily associate with Burnley. And I don't mean to say that in a sort of disrespectful manner, because I think it was a systemic thing as much as it was a sort of, you know, a happy accident pretty much. And I think yesterday you saw a Burnley side who were happy to get it down and play it a bit more, get it into the channels and that kind of thing. And that's where I think a couple of the things that they're going to class as chances in terms of, you know, the offsides and stuff like that. I think if you're Sean Dyche, you look at it and value more in the build-up players as much as you do in the actual, you know, what happens at the end of the chance.
The game begins to break on 30, Phil, which I think is quite interesting. In hindsight, Sadio Mane gets those couple of chances from the set piece where arguably you should possibly do a little bit better with the second one. He also, you just feel as though there's suddenly some pitch in front of Sadio in the way in which there isn't in front of Salah. You begin to feel there's some pitch in front of Henderson. You begin to feel there's some pitch in front of Keita, not least because he's actually helping to create that pitch in front of him. I think from about 30, Liverpool begin to settle. And from then, there's very few Burnley chances for the next hour, not just for the up to half time. And I think that's almost that period, 30 to 45, is the most important passage of play.
Yeah, you see this quite a lot with Liverpool, don't you, where they sort of feel themselves into the game and take a little bit of time, and then all of a sudden it's like, all right, we've got this sus now, and the game becomes a bit easier, and Mane started getting in behind. We started getting the sort of finding a bit of space in the middle of the park, because the first sort of 15, 20 minutes, it felt like what happened was the ball would go to Henderson or Keita and they'd have a man on them and there'd be no space. And in Henderson's case especially, he was trying to force things and he'd lose the ball. I think his pass completion rate is 50% or something, isn't it, in the game, which tells you something's not quite right, because that's just so ridiculously low. It's past where you just go, ah, yeah, fair enough. But there was a thing where we found our way, we created space and we got going a little bit, and it pushed them back a little bit. I thought they got a bit deeper towards half time, and that helps. And I think the corner for the goal comes from, I'm pretty sure it's a pretty wicked ball, isn't it? And Ben Mee just has to put it behind. And it was very close to actually going in, if I remember correctly.
Whose ball then was it?
I think it was Robertson.
Mm-hmm.
I think, I might be wrong on that, but I think he was sort of trying to just whip it across the face of goal, and Ben Mee just about nicks it behind. And then from there, you get the goal, and all of a sudden you're changing the game. The goal came at an incredibly important time. It was very similar to Brentford a few weeks ago, wasn't it, in terms of you were just starting to get a little bit, I don't really want to go into half-time at 0-0 and give them the confidence boost and the ability to go in and sort of rearrange and do this and do that. But you get the goal, and you can really, really put them on the back foot, and then they have to come out at you, and that's such a benefit to this Liverpool team.
Ian, the offsides, and especially in that sort of early run up until probably about 30, maybe a little further, I believe there is a bit of a mad match of the day to edit. I thought, just in the ground, from the body language and reactions of the Liverpool players as well, obviously Liverpool players are biased, but I thought they were just all offside. Like even one where the flag doesn't go up in the end, where Arnold sort of, Weghorst gets the shot off, it's going wide, and Trent just makes sure by knocking it out for a corner. I thought they were all offside. And
you know, there's been times this season where we very much criticised Liverpool's defensive line, felt it was too much, felt it wasn't quite right, too high or whatever. I think they get it right yesterday in a remarkably good way. This is the way Burnley think they're going to score, and Liverpool, it looked to me like they got it right over and over again.
I think massively so. I think this might be why Sean Dyche was talking about the chances they create, because against other sides who aren't going to play the high line we play, they will be much better chances for them. They are much more likely to get in. They will catch people out. I watched it on a stream, and even on a stream, even on a poor quality stream with the audio a minute ahead of the visuals, you could still see that every single one of these chances was offside. And I watched the match of the day two edit last night, and it's insane.
It is ridiculous.
They're talking about chances created, and you're looking at going, they didn't create that many chances. You know, they didn't create that many actual chances. You know, if you want to underline and put in italics, chances, they didn't create that many chances yesterday. They created things that would be chances if it wasn't for the fact that we played them offside, because when our line works and our line starts, I think we deliberately moved to this when they changed the offside rule a couple of seasons back, and we started playing a higher line at that point because we knew we could capitalise on it, we knew we could take the chance because we would be covered by VAR, and we are catching people offside. We're doing it all the time. The one thing that's infuriating is this bizarre rule that you don't flag until the phase of play is finished. This bizarre rule that is only going to be changed when somebody does a hamstring or somebody does an ACL chasing after a ball that was offside 30 seconds previously.
Well, that was the one where Cornet runs into Alisson, and honestly, that gave me the yips for all future decisions, because he was about a mile off. I think it was Jay Rodriguez actually who initially runs off and then passes it to Cornet, and Cornet runs straight into Alisson.
Is that the one where Alisson pushed him to the right, and then takes the ball?
Oh, no, that's later on as well.
I think I understand why they do this late flag, but some of them are so obviously offside it's a waste of everyone's time. Like the Cornet one in the second half that you were talking about there is not close. It's not the kind of thing that a linesman should be looking across and going, oh, we might have to play on here. He is 2 yards offside.
Yeah.
And there's also a thing where they don't make the time up that they've just wasted from it.
No.
They, you know, that attack took 15 seconds. We played 3 minutes of added time. How many times are they offside? They've got to go back. That is dead time. And that's great when you're winning 1-0. Absolutely fantastic when you're winning 1-0. But we're making football games shorter by having things that literally do not matter. It's stupid.
Well, just the other thing that irritates me on that as well, when I mentioned the Veghorst one before, in the end, Trent put it out for a corner, which was the sensible thing to do, but Burnley get a corner. He was offside. And there's a little bit of that. There's almost a way to game this a tiny little bit. It was interesting. There was one in the second half where I think Jota or Robertson were a little bit offside, and whoever it is who gets it, because they knock it back with the linesman, feels confident enough to put his flag up. If he'd have just run forward and got a throw, I presume he would have just ended up getting a throw or even a corner or something, you know. And that's, I think, on it, Josh. I think it shows real courage from a Liverpool point of view. You know, I think it helps in a really weird way. I don't think the goalkeeper actually makes a meaningful save that mattered. It's a really weird thing to say. I think he shows repeatedly what a good goalkeeper he is, but I don't think any of it was accounted. The flip side of that, though, is I think it's part of why they can all be quite calm, and they do manage to keep an unbelievable level of faith. And it's interesting, it's his two most senior centre-halves he seems to be going with at the moment around this, because Matip and Van Dijk can look at each other and go, we'll just take no notice of this idiocy. Yeah. We'll just crack on and keep doing what we're doing, because we know we're right. We don't need a camera. We know we were right there, but also we know this fella behind us will bail us out.
Yeah, and you're right to say it's courageous, because you know there's scenarios in which Liverpool could find themselves this season where, you know, Burnley had it yesterday where Burnley were sort of playing more off the shoulder, which I think was probably a mistake on their part, and one they probably didn't account for coming up against Liverpool's high line. But you're going to get teams who have runners coming in from deeper to try and sort of exploit that Liverpool high line. And it was funny yesterday, like I watched on the stream, like Ian, and the commentators were constantly sort of, you know, worrying or setting a narrative at least about Liverpool's high line, and then talking about these offside chances that Burnley were like supposedly getting. And it was like, well, like which one is it? Liverpool playing with a good high line, or a Burnley getting in behind and getting these chances? And I think, as Ian said, it's something you've seen from Liverpool for a number of years now, and it's obviously a sort of a thing in terms of that, like, bravery that Liverpool have been playing with, in particular the centre halves, Virgil van Dijk and Joel Matip. I think that's one way you've seen from their line, and you know, the ability of Alisson Becker. It's a strange one, because you can look at the sort of offside chance and things that Burnley don't have or have yesterday, and you still look at it, you can still come away from it feeling like Alisson Becker has a good performance, but all the things he has to deal with are the offside chances. It's like, a sort of weird thing you fall into.
At the end of the match, he came over to our end like, I played well there. He really had. I mean, that's the point was he felt like he really contributed. But you know, whether or not that's there or not is separate. To me, Ian, both centre backs looking all of a sudden looking 2018, 2019 shape. Virgil was coming back at the start of the season from an injury. Matip had been, obviously had an injury himself last year. I don't think Liverpool are necessarily quite tip-top in this area of the pitch as autumn turned to winter. Last year, there's conceding three at West Ham, conceding three at Brentford. I'm not entirely clear on precisely who started centre-half, it just occurs to me, but I do think, you know, conceding three at Atletico Madrid, Matip and Van Dijk definitely start that one. But right now, they look in the absolute peak of the 18-19 form that drove us to 97 points in a European Cup.
Absolutely, they look imperious. They're completely commanding at the back. It's the fact that we've got that solidity between the two, but also the creativity. We've got the long balls from Virgil, but we've got Matip quite happy to wander up the pitch, which gives us another attacking option. So they know they've got the surety. And I think there was talk at the beginning of the season about Robbo possibly holding the line back a little bit, and he's not doing that any longer. He's back to where he was. So I think that the fact that he's attacking as he normally does gives the two lads in the centre the knowledge that they have just got to think about their own line because there's nobody else to think about at all. And they're completely commanding. You know, between them, Fabinho and Alisson, anything that comes our way is going to be dealt with. That's how we look at the moment.
You mentioned Alisson there, mentions Fabinho as well. Phil, that four, almost like this diamond, it is as good as anything else in world football, in European football. This is... if the bedrock on which, if Liverpool are going to catch Manchester City, it is going to be this. That's the bedrock of it, I think. But also, we're talking about, there's three other trophies that Liverpool can win, and they're going to be the bedrock of that too. I think, well, we'll chat about who we actually think are going to start at Inter Milan in a little while. But for me, Liverpool know what the first choice is here, and it is Alisson Becker in goal, Fabinho at holding midfield, it's Virgil van Dijk, and it's Joe Matip.
It is, and there's also ways where you can sort of take one of them out and the others are still able to sort of make it okay. Like, there was obviously, we've had the spell where Keller has been in goal. Keller plays away at Chelsea. And I don't even think Fabinho was there at Chelsea, was he? Did Fabinho have COVID at Chelsea? I think he might have.
Yeah, he did, yes.
So you take two out and it still looked pretty all right. So it's a great example of how good we are, but also how good the depth is as well. I think it also creates a situation where I think teams look at it and try and play wide, which then helps us because we want the ball in wide areas anyway.
Yeah.
We want to get Trent on the ball, we want to get Roberts on the ball. And if they're then doing that, they're looking at Thiago, and Thiago's suddenly in a bit of space when you get him the ball, and so on and so forth. And there's so many ways this Liverpool team can hurt you, and one of the ways that we do it is by stopping teams from hurting us in a really interesting way that teams don't want to go near that. And they want to try and actively work away from doing it. I thought that Burnley were a bit too quick to throw balls down the middle yesterday at the centre backs. I thought they would have been a bit better trying to sort of potentially work it down channels in behind full backs, and they didn't do that, and I thought a little bit naive from them. But it was just as a foursome, I don't think there's anyone, I can't think of anyone who's better. I think City's is very competitive in line with ours, but outside of that, I just can't see anyone who's even close.
Then we talk about the supporting cast, those in front. Josh, I thought Keita grew into the game really, really well. He begins to create his own space on around 25. And then from about 25 to about 45, I think Liverpool are in the ascendancy and the goal comes. It then becomes a different challenge, I think, in the second 45 minutes. And I think Keita does a good job of killing the game as well, of making sure that not much happens, but with Liverpool with a semblance of control, both in and out of possession. It was a good performance, but I also think it was a vote of confidence in just getting this one in general.
Yeah, I think there's a strange thing first half, I think, with Naby Keita, where he finds himself almost with more pitch than he feels like he knows what to do with. I think he's expecting, you know, more pressing from Burnley's midfielders, but also just maybe a bit more in terms of that sort of toughness that you associate with Burnley sides down the years. And I wonder whether he went in with that preconception a little bit first half, and that's maybe why he was a little bit on the sheepish side. But I think you're right to say that he does grow into it. And I think that's as Liverpool start to sort of build more control, and you've talked about the, you know, those four in particular. But I think the sort of Fabinho and Van Dijk axis because Keita's on the left-hand side of the midfield yesterday, just allows Keita to sort of, you know, find the positions that he needs to take up and find the areas of the pitch in which he can be important and can get on the ball and can sort of make things happen a bit more going forward. And I think that's what you see yesterday. And I think, to be honest, him and Mane on that side link up really, really well as well. And I think, you know, it wasn't necessarily either his or Mane's best performance. It probably wasn't even their best performance in tandem. But I think that's a relationship which is obviously, you know, thrives off the pitch, but is beginning to thrive on the pitch as well, which is good to see.
It's important, I think, Ian, that, you know, as much as possible, it's pointed out when Keita is just very, very steady, because I think there's always been the notion that he's got to turn up and be phenomenal. But that's not what you're asked to do in a Liverpool midfield most of the time. There are times where, you know, we need people to come to the party a little bit, but on the whole, the job of the Liverpool midfield, especially in difficult away games like that one, is don't let anyone down, do your job pretty well, keep control where you can, act as a basis for other people to go and play, and he does all of those things really well.
Yeah, I was leaving Anfield one of the last two games. Keita had played, I think, and being anonymous, so I can't remember which game it was, but I was saying to our kid, I genuinely don't know what he offers to us at the moment. I don't know what he offers as a player. We both think that it was a transfer that hasn't worked, and we'll look back and go, well, yeah, we paid a lot of money for him, it hasn't really worked. But I thought he was excellent yesterday. I thought from very early on, I'd have him as man of the match. I thought he really, it wasn't a case of imposing himself on the game. He just kept the ball moving. He did what was necessary in terms of keeping the engine going. And if he can do that on a regular basis, the player we thought that we were getting who was going to decorate every game, who was going to run the game, who was going to impose himself on everything and dominate the midfield, clearly isn't the player he is for us. So if he can just keep the ball moving and keep possession and get it to somebody else, and you know, the little interchange between him and Mane where they were swapping positions and moving in and out of each other, it's, if he keeps doing that, then that's fine. That's a bloody good thing to be able to do for the team.
Yeah, he came in with a sort of, this is what he's going to do, he's going to be incredible. But there was a weird thing between him signing for Liverpool and joining Liverpool, which was a 12-month period.
Yeah.
The entire shape of the team changed, because when he signed, Trent Alexander-Arnold and Andy Robertson were not things. You know, Trent had barely played. Alberto Mourinho played 6 months at left-back before Robertson gets in. What we wanted from midfield has changed massively, and it affected Chamberlain as well, I think, in a way. Whereas now we're nearly, four years down the line of his time at the club, and he doesn't need to be this player anymore. He just needs to come in, and if he's 7 out of 10 every game for the rest of the season, that will be fine, because he won't be asked to use the ball like Thiago does. He won't be asked to win the ball and help the defensive structure of the team like Fabinho is. He just needs to come in and be decent and keep the ball ticking over and be absolutely a part of the unit, as opposed to this player that was gliding past players and scoring goals and winning the ball 65 times a game. It'd be great if he could do that.
But it helps. I think you get a little bit of that, I think, during this game, Phil, where what he's good at and what he now can really do for us in those sorts of games, certainly when it's so compact, is I don't think he's now going to glide past three, which is some of what we saw on the videos. But when he drops his shoulder, he gets himself a bit of space away from one and then moves the ball again. Well, it really helps you break a press, and break a press like Burnley's press. All of a sudden, you've got a bit of space to move into. People got to worry about him a little bit more, and you've got to back up the lad who's going to go to him, if you know what I mean. I think he does that really well yesterday, and that he gets himself a yard, and in doing that, he gets the next player 2 yards, if you see what I mean.
Yeah, what I said then sounded a little bit harsh, and it wasn't really what, I didn't really quite mean it as a criticism or anything like that, and he's still capable of doing these things, but it's just a slight difference in what you actually need of him. I think when he's on, he's a lovely player to watch as well. That's the thing about him. I really enjoy the way him and Thiago are both just able to create themselves 5 yards of space by dropping the shoulder one way. It's a genuine joy to watch, and it's a very important thing for this team, because if you create 5 yards of space, all of a sudden you've opened the game right up, which is something we quite often find ourselves needing to do.
Since 2011, for instance, a summer where Liverpool are then strongly linked with Clint Dempsey, there has always been a desire to end Jordan Henderson's Liverpool career. All plots lead to death. At some point, somebody will say Jordan Henderson shouldn't be a first-team player for Liverpool anymore, and they'll be absolutely right to do so, because by virtue of the fact eventually that day will come. He may be 39 at the time, it might be today.
But he's 46, you know, just imagine how angry people have been.
He's just continually finding a way to get back into that side over and over. over and over again. It's a strange thing that there does need to be this sort of quasi-referendum on him over and over again. But he has had, what I would say, Josh, is he's had a season that I think has actually been... I think it's had more highs than some of the seasons he's had in the past, Goodison Park away being an example of it, but it's also had one or two quite significant lows. Mm. But there is a consistency question, both in terms of performance game to game, but also sometimes within games. I think it's a little bit in terms of what he's asked to do. When he gets a bad knock yesterday, it looked a bad knock in real time. Doesn't play well, though. I don't think he'll be coming out. He'll come away from Burnley feeling as though he had a belter or anything like that.
No, it's interesting because as soon as he gets the knock, it sort of looks like at first in particular he almost can't put his leg straight when he runs. So the first few runs he does after that just look completely uncomfortable. I was almost surprised by how long he stayed on the pitch, to be honest, because I thought there was a chance that
he gets, because he gets booked in the same incident as well. He gets himself injured because he's miscontrolled it and he's trying to make up for it.
Yeah, he almost gives Jurgen Klopp a move to just take him off a bit earlier. But maybe it says a lot about the influence that Klopp still feels like he has on this side, that he does keep him on. But I think you're right to sort of talk about the consistency thing, because I think one of the things we've come to expect from Jordan Henderson in particular, and a lot of it isn't just in terms of leadership, but there's also performance on the pitch, the way he makes his side tick and things like that. I don't think you're starting to see as much of that impact on a consistent basis anymore, and I think it's because, as you say, there are just games thrown in every now and then, particularly this season. There have been a couple last season which have all the mitigating circumstances around them, but there's games where Jordan Henderson just doesn't look quite like the Jordan Henderson you'd expect, and there's some games where he doesn't look quite like the Jordan Henderson you'd expect in a good way. I think of AC Milan at home, where you never want to sort of make this comparison because it was all the lazy comparisons back in the day, but he's almost Steven Gerrard-esque in his performance, in terms of that captain's performance, in terms of getting the goal, in terms of driving the team on, keeping the team on the front foot. But as you say, there's just been that sort of up and down, and yesterday did feel like one of the downs, but he'll know that just as much as anybody else. And it's one of the funny things about the criticism around him is that you always feel like he will be the biggest critic of himself, no matter how big the biggest critic is.
It's one for me, Phil, where I don't think it was a day where it suited to have him and Trent doing similar things, first and foremost, with the weather being the way in which it was. There's something else with it as well. You mentioned the pass completion before. I've always said, and I think any sort of decent observance of his game sees, that he puts a lot of balls into areas. They're not actually balls that are meant to be ideally met by a Liverpool player. It's the idea, if I put it over here, I will create a load of doubt, then there'll be a second ball scenario, and then we'll start playing again from there, and you never know. The problem with that yesterday was, firstly, the weather. Secondly, that just sort of suits Burnley a little bit, because firstly, these are really good centre-halves in Tarkowski and me. But also, secondly, they play on that similar sort of razor's edge, if you know what I mean. It just all felt a little bit of a perfect storm for him not to be able to really impose himself. Although, again, I actually think he's quite good the 5 minutes before half-time when Liverpool get themselves on top.
Yeah, if you actually go back and watch his goal he scored in the derby, it starts from a ball he plays out towards Mane in a very similar way. It's that way, it's no look, it's into space, and Mane has to basically chase it down and not quite win it, but he has to basically get the ball as opposed to just gone to him. Now, you talk about ball into areas, and also this is a slight thing that Mane didn't do yesterday. There's a ball he puts in on about 20-25, which is genuinely incredible.
The one that Roberts clears, yeah.
And Mane doesn't gamble. If Mane gambles, he probably scores, yeah. But Mane doesn't gamble, and it is genuinely the kind of ball that, if Mane gets on the end of it, people would probably go, that's an amazing ball. If it's Trent or Kevin De Bruyne, they are talking about it on Match of the Day for a week. It was that good. Now, this isn't to say he played well or anything, but there are still things in him that he can do. And I think you're absolutely right in that he's happy to sort of... He's not bothered about his pass completion, I don't think. There's a time when it's too low, and 50% is too low. Let's be brutally honest about this. And he didn't play well by any stretch of the imagination yesterday. But I think a lot of his design and how the manager tells him to play as well is about sort of creating a little bit of chaos, whereas Thiago's about control. He's a little bit more chaos. And I watch Liverpool sometimes and I'm thinking, did we give the ball away deliberately there? Because if you can give the ball away deliberately and then you hound someone, because some of the times we give the ball away, the front three are on them far too quickly for it to make sense that it's just a careless pass. And maybe they're just really good at what they do and being alert and aware. But some of the times I see it and I think, did he mean to do that? And then you get them back up the pitch. It's like the way Gomez told that story about shooting to end the attack.
Yeah.
In a very similar way, just slightly different. And yeah, he's not had... He's had a weird season.
It's been weird more than bad
games,
I think.
But then you look at Salah's goal, Salah's fifth at Old Trafford, the ball is incredible. Yes. He scored it away at Everton. He scores a fantastic goal at home to Brighton.
He plays six at Old Trafford in that game.
He does. He's had. I think there's going to come. I mean, it wouldn't surprise me from next season. He's sort of fourth man in the midfield.
That's what
and
I think.
We have this situation where he comes in and he goes, right, I'll do Fabinho today. I'll do Thiago today. I'll do
whoever's the right
whoever, side of which I think will be someone we sign in the summer. And his role, he'll still play 35, 40 games a season, fitness permitting. But I think the days where you're sort of going, right, Henderson's the first name on one of the first names on the team sheet are probably coming to an end. And I think it's all fine. This is how football works. They can't just keep going forever. But he still has plenty to offer. There's still a very good footballer there. Ultimately, he just needs to sort himself out a little bit at the minute, I think.
I think at times it's hard. The other thing, that first half, first 15 minutes, 20 minutes, I thought the Matip pass to Trent, the Trent ball to Henderson, the Fabinho ball to Trent or Henderson, Ian, wasn't quite happening for Liverpool at all. And I thought that wasn't just any one of them. I felt over and over again, it was just the stuff was going out of touch. I think it was partially the conditions, it was partially the intensity. I thought you got to see that. I think Trent also has a funny game. He very nearly creates the winner, obviously, in the inside left channel with about 15 to go, 5 to go, sorry, with the own goal. Just pops up there, you know, Liverpool are 1-0 up away at Turf Moor. That's where you're right back, you'd expect them to be. But he has, again, I think he has quite a funny game too. Certainly a funny first half where he just can't quite get to grips with what's going on around him.
Yeah, I've got to say, on the stream I was watching, I didn't notice that it was problematic for him as such. There's the moment up on the top right in the first half where he tries to control the ball and manages to put it out of play himself.
Yeah.
And you're looking and go, okay, well, that's clearly the weather. That's just one of those things. It's not something I thought was massively an issue yesterday, and it's one of those things where if it was an issue yesterday, it won't be on Wednesday. So he's allowed those games every so often. It's kind of like to return to the Jordan Henderson question as well. One of the benefits of being really, really old is that in the early 80s, which I am, in the early 80s, I stood on the cop and turned to my uncle and said, I don't know why we play Souness anymore. He's finished. He then blammed in a shot from 40 yards. And at that moment, I stopped having opinions about things because I couldn't get it at all. I did the same thing with Kenny. You know, he hasn't been the same player since he had his cheek broke. Yeah, it's just, you look at these things and go, well, they're nonsense, aren't they? I'm not saying the Trent point is nonsense. Obviously, he obviously didn't have a great game, but
it was a difficult game to have a great game.
It's one of those games where it was just a shitty game of football, basically.
He looked like he was getting dead frustrated with himself as well. I don't know if it was necessarily with himself or the circumstance. The commentators had a bit of a different opinion to me on what it was. There's one pass in particular where Joel Matip tries to play out to him at right back, and I think Trent's just in a different position to where he expects him to be, and it just goes out for a throw in, and Trent sort of almost has a bit of a throw up of the arms, and I think it wasn't necessarily a disagreement with Matip as such. I think he was just genuinely thinking, like, how the fuck do I get myself into this game? Because it's just not happening for me at the moment. You know, like Ian mentioned, the touch high up the pitch, there was a few times where I think Trent just felt like he could have been a bit more a part of the attack, a bit more influential, got that ball into the box, got the ball at the right time, and it just wasn't quite there for so, so long.
Can I just go sideways for a second and address the commentator's issue? Because obviously everyone's watching different streams. So the one thing you find watching different streams is that all commentators are equally wrong about the things we're watching.
Mine was Italian, so I've got no idea, mate.
Oh, there's just wrong still.
Phil, there's a thing about on that where by some distance I've pulled me things together for video subscribers on the Anfield Rap through StatsBomb on the shape of the game. And Burnley's intensity is by far the greatest on the left-hand side of the pitch, their left, all around the halfway line. And I think that at times it's perfectly reasonable to think a clever man like Sean Dyche sets a team up to say, let's really not let Alexander-Arnold get any rhythm. And I thought that was one of the best examples of that I've actually seen, where they really flooded that position. There was bodies everywhere. It was interesting he chose not to start McNeil, I think, with that in mind as well. And I like McNeil as a player, but I thought it was a really interesting selection. McNeil doesn't start because I think McNeil likes to play a bit more football. To me, it looked as though Burnley's decision was, we will just absolutely scrap in this area so they never get to settle. And I think that wasn't about Mo Salah. That wasn't about Jordan Henderson. It wasn't about Fabinho. It wasn't about Matip. It was about Trent Alexander-Arnold.
Yeah, it was almost the perfect storm, and it being a hard day for Trent because, as you say, the team we were playing made it very, very difficult for him. And also, I think he's the player who sort of suffers the most in those conditions, whereby the pitch becomes more slick, which when he's playing a 50, 60 yard crossfield ball, it's much harder to play those because they skip off the turf and the wind might catch it and so on and so forth. So that is one of his biggest tools, is being able to get the ball and go bang out, switch the play and make the pitch bigger. He had that taken away from him. Once he's got that taken away from him, he's also got Maxwell Cornet in his face on a regular basis, which, again, that's hard as well. So basically leaves him with the options of, I've basically either got to beat him or I've just got to play this ball short. And that's not really what he wants to do, because he wants to be involved. He wants to be playing these absolutely phenomenal passes that set teams away. He wants to be making triangles with Salah, and he just wasn't able to yesterday. But it's fine because it enabled other people to do other things. Like Andy Robertson had one of his best games for a while, I thought he was very, very good. And there was a thought process before Christmas, wasn't there, where it was, oh, maybe Shimmercastle challenging, whereas I think we've probably put that one to bed to an extent now. And he seems to have got the line more, whereas, as Ian said before, one of the big things, I think if you remember the Brighton game, Brighton equalised because I think he's 2 yards deeper than the rest of the
defense. At least.
That is not happening anymore. So he's obviously sat down, looked at what he was doing wrong. It's to his credit that he's eradicated it from his game. And it's, once he's eradicated it, the whole thing becomes a lot more settled, as, you know, the number of offsides is obscene, isn't it, ultimately? And he's playing a part in that, and it's now able to function properly.
All those early season wobbles do appear out the way for Robertson. Josh, again, couldn't be timed better. We are going to a Champions League last 16 game. There's a final on the horizon. It does seem it's another example of this squad sort of coming to the boil quite nicely with Robertson there.
Absolutely, yeah. And I think it's good that Phil mentions the thing about Tsimikas earlier in the season, really, because I think one of the qualities we all saw in Tsimikas, which we probably were starting to lose sight of in Robertson, I suppose, was that offensive influence, that ability to, you know, just cause a bit of chaos on that left hand side, get in and interchange with whoever is playing on the left wing, which obviously for the most part Sadio Mane. I think Robertson at the start of the season didn't really have much of that. I think he found himself a bit almost non-placed at left back in terms of where he was literally meant to be. And I can't remember which game it was necessarily. There was one game where he just seems to sort of catch fire and it feels like it's all right. I think it might be Southampton at home, I want to say, maybe, where he just seems to start getting it all right and you feel like it's Andy Robertson again, you know, going backwards and going forwards. And I think going forwards has been the most important thing for him this season. And I think you see that in the Burnley game yesterday, is that going forward, he just has such an influence. And Phil mentions the one that he whips in, which Ben Mee clears at the sort of front post. He's just causing those bits of chaos again now, which is, you know, so handy for this Liverpool side, because we're not a side that are necessarily scoring, you know, loads of goals at the back post at the minute. But it's the sort of thing where we need to have a load of different weapons to our arsenal, particularly when we're going forward and when teams are setting up in the ways that teams are setting up against us. And I think Andy Robertson is just so crucial to that in a completely different way to the way Trent is, but, you know, as important as Trent is to it.
The front three, Ian, and I wanted to sort of talk about them in this context all together at once. They have been the front three. They are the lads who've been doing the business for us since 2017. There may not be that many more games they have where all three of them play together for a variety of reasons. But I think it's interesting how, firstly, that he chooses them for this, for Burnley away in that weather, and secondly, how much of a battling performance he gets out of all three. Firmino has a bit of a curate egg of a game, to be honest with you, where you'd like more from him in the final third, but my God, does he feel so influential in the middle third of the pitch in terms of looking after the ball for Liverpool. Salah is scrapping with everybody, probably has hard lines around the penalty. Mane, for the period of time that he was on the pitch, you know, he was beginning to run direct on a couple of occasions, but again, it's a physical battle that all three of them choose to have.
Yeah, I think Salah's penalty, I think if he'd have actually gone down, he probably would have got the penalty. But I think the problem was he stayed up and tried to go for the ball, and then the game continues and the VAR's kind of like, yeah, what the hell. Firmino, I think, was very much, he seems to play the first half as a midfielder.
Yeah.
He started at the front, but he dropped deep very, very quickly and stayed there for a long time. I thought he was effective there, and that could be, you know, we saw him swapped into midfield a couple of weeks back, and that could be somewhere where he has a bit more of a future as well. It could be somewhere that he controls the game from. Mane, I thought he was kind of in and out yesterday. I was expecting him to hit the ground with some real pace, in the way that when Mo came on the other night, he hit the ground, they had a point to prove. Obviously, Mane doesn't have a point to prove. He can celebrate how great he is at the moment. But it was a game where he had to play, because you wouldn't have wanted Diaz to play in that game, because that's no way to discover this is what English football is actually like.
I love, you know, Klopp's quote on that as yeah. well. I think one of the journalists asked Klopp, like, why didn't you bring Diaz on? And he was like, come on, it's Burnley away, give the lad some time.
Yeah. I like the idea, he's just gone, fucking hell, have you seen that, mate?
Does Liverpool have got between now and the end of the season, Phil? They've not actually got that many away league games left to play. It's something that's been perhaps slightly missed in some dispatches. There's not a ton. Liverpool have still got to go to Arsenal. They've got to go to Brighton. They've got to go to Manchester City, which is very much its own thing. Villa, Newcastle and Southampton, they're the remaining away league games. It wouldn't surprise me, though, if in a couple of them you see Liverpool turn up and it is the front three that at least start those games a little bit more than you might think, given Jota's goal scoring form. In that, I think if in between that there's big Champions League games, you know, Klopp's got this big squad to work out how to use now, and I wonder if it'll be a little bit... The lads who know the course, know the distance, will get 60 minutes to start with, and then I work out what my next move is.
Yeah, I agree with that, but it's just ultimately it's just nice to have this, be able to have this discussion, because it's, you know, the back end of 18, 19, 19, 20, it was the same lads going again pretty much every week, and there's no way of changing it even within the game, never mind at the start of the game. So to have this luxury is fantastic, but I think you are right that I think we're going to be, I mean, we're probably... Saturday, Wednesday, until the international break, which is another month away, isn't it? So I think there's 5 weeks. The Arsenal game is, I'm pretty sure it's going to get rearranged for the 16th of March.
Which, be amazed if it doesn't.
Yeah, I'd be amazed if it doesn't as well. So with that, that's every single midweek we've got a game until the internationals, which is, it's hard going. But what we've got now is the ability to go, well, you can play there, and the idea that these three lads who've been there and done it can go to Arsenal and go, right, this is what we're doing. And they can go to Southampton, which is potentially going to be a massive game, because it's either the last weekend of the season or the last midweek of the season, FA Cup dependent. And if we're still in the mix, that is going to be absolutely monumental game where you want these lads to go there and go, right, we're doing this. And if you remember... Southampton away, that fantastic Friday night, it was those three, wasn't it? And
yeah,
they had to work for it, and they know exactly what they need to do.
Best night of your life. 7 point gap to Chelsea, a job done there, really. 7 point gap to Chelsea, 9 to City, but the game in hand obviously exists. 7 to Chelsea now, Chelsea coming back, same number of games played now as Chelsea as well. I think all that's broken. Chelsea have a bit of a weird remainder of the season, I think, where they're just going to sort of cruise to third and see what they do in Europe. Inter Milan, Josh, becomes very much a don't lose special. The second in Serie A, one behind AC, 1-1 with Napoli on Saturday. Napoli a third, by the way, only 1 point behind, I think, themselves, Inter Milan. They're a really good side. There's no Barella. He's got a 2-game suspension, and there's a bit of intelligence that might be a big deal. He statistically profiles very progressively for them, helps create a lot of what they do. That's good going forward, so that's good for us as well. But it's also their first Champions League knockout in a decade. The question is, how much can they hurt Liverpool?
Yeah, this is what's interesting, because I think when we drew AC Milan in the groups, I was particularly interested to see the way that AC Milan had sort of gone through their rebuild, because it had been so many years since we'd played them. I was interested to see, you know, what sort of side we were going to get. You know, AC Milan are going to be the name, but you don't know necessarily what it felt like, a bit of an unknown entity almost in terms of what Liverpool are going to come up against. And as you see in sort of both the games, Liverpool are more than sort of fixed to be able to beat a side like AC Milan. And I'm interested to see whether it's much of the same for Inter. I can't say that I've watched, you know, much or if any of Inter this season or in the past few seasons, but I'm really intrigued by the prospect of that, and really intrigued to see, you know, Liverpool in this Liverpool side in knockout stage football again, because I think for the past few seasons now it's felt like this Liverpool side hasn't necessarily in terms of foundation been set up for Champions League knockout football. But at the moment, with the foundation that this side are building, and we've mentioned, you know, about the sort of spine of this side, you can't help but feel just excited going into these games and feel like there's loads to come from Liverpool.
Ian, the idea of pick me a team suddenly now becomes increasingly difficult. The other thing to point out as well is that the manager gets 5 subs. This is a game where Liverpool, you know, they will want to be strong, very, very strong indeed. But it is not a must win. It is very much a don't lose. And I think that that's going to be an important part of the manager's mentality as well. But I think the flip side of this is if Liverpool can find a way clear to score on a couple of goals, then my God, they will feel as though they're very much in charge in the tie.
Yeah, I think it's, you know, when I saw the agenda, it was kind of like, I bumped into Phil on the way in, it's like, how are you? I'm like, yeah, sound, just found out how little I know about Inter Milan. And then looked at their season to date and went, so, you know, these lads win games and they score goals, but they also concede goals. So, you know, being a couple of 2-2 draws there. So I think I say, don't lose and score, which is the perfect away, basically. So, you know, 1-1 draw would be quite decent for us. But I think if we go strong and we can get a couple of goals against them, we won't set up in the first leg. I think it's a strong team. And I think it's a, do you want me to go with the team?
If you've got some, I'll ask you the obvious questions. I think we can all agree goalkeeper, two full backs, Van Dijk starts.
Yeah.
So who plays at centre-half?
Matip.
You think he goes with Matip?
Yeah.
Okay. Phil?
I think Matip's played, I think, 3 games in 7 days is a lot for Joel Matip. And I do wonder, that you've seen the manager was happy to rotate the centre-backs in Europe in the group stage. I mean, Van Dijk felt like he didn't play any of the first 3 or 4 group games. Yeah. And you just wonder if this might be the game Konate gets. And then you can give Van Dijk the rest on Saturday and play Matip and Konate.
I just wonder whether there's Joe Gomez, Mickey. It's been that interesting sort of seeing Jurgen Klopp's quotes around Gomez for the past few weeks and how he's been really emphasising that sort of unlucky tag about Gomez. And Gomez has been, you know, back fit for a couple of days now. He had the little COVID scare, which I think it makes him miss the Leicester game. But he's been back in training and misses out on the two squads. And I just wonder whether Jurgen Klopp just needs to give him that bit of incentive again. And what more incentive than a start in the San Siro in the Champions League?
Okay. Fabinho starts. Who else starts in midfield, Phil?
Thiago is 100% starting if he didn't start yesterday.
Yeah.
And I think it wouldn't shock me if it was Chamberlain. I think a European away game, getting someone who can get you up the pitch, get his head down and move the ball really well, link up with the fullbacks, go outside and is able to put a ball in from out wide. I don't necessarily think he will, but I think that's possibly what I would do.
Okay.
It could be any of four, really, though, couldn't it? It's brilliant.
Thiago, Chamberlain, what are you going with?
Henderson.
I think I'm doing Thiago and Keita, and I think he gives himself a move to do Henderson again at the weekend and gives Henderson a little bit of time in this one.
You see, I
think Henderson will be Fabinho against Norwich.
I'm going to split the vote here, and I think it'll be Elliot. I think he'll start Elliot in this one.
See, not four different names. This is great.
I think he's had his eye on Elliot for this one for a while. To be honest with you, I think he'll want to see what it looks like, and also I think that's where the 5 subs thing really helps. And if it's not going well, he can do it at all.
So, time. I think the 5 subs in the context of a first leg is actually really interesting because the game's never dead.
Yeah,
and you sort of associate 5 subs with, like, which 5 do you bring off? For example, like if it's 0-0. You're not bringing Salah off, are you?
No.
You're not bringing Robertson off. You're not bringing Trent off. There's 3 gone immediately. You're not bringing Van Dijk off. There's 4.
Yep.
So how do you make these 5? It's a nice thing to have the 5 subs, but it's also really hard to see how you use all of them unless we're 2-0 up, 3-0 up, which is obviously quite unlikely.
It is indeed. Front 3, Ian, who do you think he's going with? Obviously Salah.
Obviously Salah, Mane and Jota.
Yep.
I was thinking Salah, Diaz and Jota. Interestingly, I think there's a bit of a strange thing that happens at the weekend where Jota doesn't train on the Saturday, I think it is. So he ends up having to start Mane and bring Jota off the bench. And I just wonder whether, if he hadn't have done that, whether we would see Salah, Mane and Diaz in this one. But yeah, I've got a feeling there's Salah, Diaz and Jota.
They've had a funny run of form into Milan, Phil. They beat Roma in the Coppa Italia, but they got beat by Milan in a massive derby. They also had a sticky 0-0 away at Atalanta in there as well recently. They looked before Christmas as though they were on the march, genuinely on the march, and they've sort of stuttered a little bit. I sometimes wonder with this, have they stuttered a little bit because a lot of energy and preparation is going into the two-legged affair against Liverpool, or have they stuttered a little bit because they were a side who were always going to stutter a tiny little bit anyway, and they've also got a lot of Edin Dzeko.
Yeah, I think when the draw was made, there was a thing, we just absolutely wiped the floor with Milan, this will be fine. Play Inter, and you know they're about the same level, when I think they're actually quite a bit better than
AC Milan.
A general thing. One thing that's quite interesting is they lose Brella for 2 games, and he talked about the importance of him before. Bastoni went off injured against Milan last week. He's a very important part of their defence. He plays left side of the back three, and he's big, he's strong, he's very good on the ball, and he will be a huge miss. I've just seen the name of the lad who played there on Saturday against Napoli, and I don't recognise the name. And I think he's number 32. I've never heard of him.
DeMarco.
I don't know who he is.
He hooks him, so, which is interesting. Yeah. He gets subbed for D'Ambrosio.
D'Ambrosio, I think, is actually a fullback by trade. So that is an area of weakness, and that's obviously who's playing in that position for us. It's Mohamed Salah. That's a real area for us.
You've heard of him?
Yeah. And it's not just Mohamed Salah, but it's the fact that we're really good at playing triangles around that area of the pitch and sort of manipulating people out of position and creating loads of space. So they're a very good team, and I think a lot of people have underestimated the strength of this draw. We should go through. I think the away goals has been removed, hasn't it, this season, obviously, and I think that creates a really interesting situation where it doesn't really matter as long as we don't lose now. Because if we draw 1-1, it means if we draw at Anfield, the worst thing we're getting is penalties. If we avoid defeat, the worst thing you get is a penalty shootout. And how many times do we lose at Anfield? And how many times do we win at Anfield? So we should be in a position where we beat them, we're better than them, we're stronger than them in every area, ultimately. So here's a reason to be positive, I think.
Excellent stuff indeed. Thank you very much to Josh, to Phil, and to Ian, Andy Heaton for producing as well. Liverpool go to Burnley, do the decent thing, keep themselves in the hunt on all four fronts. Download that app. There's four fronts, for God's sake. Four fronts, you never know the likes. Sports Social Podcast Network.